you, please, of the bill tonight at 7:30, in 360, in 3654, John Lenoir's The Great Illusion, with English subtitles. And let me tell you again, though many of you have seen the film, that it is, without doubt, the greatest war film ever made. And if you look at this film, and you look at Apocalypse Now, you are convinced of the decline of almost everything, especially filmmaking. Yeah? So, I would advise you to see The Great Illusion by John Lenoir. It will become relevant a little later in the course itself. Now, there will be no sections this week, I've told you already. We have a lecture on Friday. You must now have picked up or pick up from Barry your 12 weeks. And when you pick up your 12 weeks, because you've asked about it, of course you're not supposed to write on all of the 50 books. You write only on one. And remember the deadline for turning it in as well. And if you have any questions, please ask us about it. You should get going about it after all your 6 weeks of trials are over. The 6 weeks in this particular class will be given to you, back to you on Monday, which will give plenty of time for you to consult with either Barry or myself about the grades that some of you will undoubtedly be receiving. Now, what, well, you have to consult with us, because, I mean, later, if you get a D of C or below, in any case. Now, last time, I tried to make clear Freud in his setting, not as a psychoanalyst would treat him, because I'm not concerned here with whether it's correct or not. The only answer to that is, if it helps you, it's correct. If it doesn't help you, it's not correct. Nor am I concerned here with the truth or falsehood of Freud's proof, which was his case studied, and the result of his case studied. But what I was concerned with is to make perhaps two things clear to you as best I could. One is that, of course, psychoanalysis was a product of history. It grew out of a particular historical constellation, very much related to the revolt of youth that we have talked about. It grew out of the particular situation of the Jewish middle class in Vienna. And it grew out of positivism, above all, because Freud was a positivist. He was a scientist. He believed that what he was doing was, in fact, a positivist, scientific, provable activity, which we must not forget. And yet, of course, there was an inherent contradiction, because this positivist, this man who was devoted to reason, and who thought that only reason counted, really, who was scared to death by the first modern mass movement, which was, like all these mass movements, also an anti-Semitic mass movement in Vienna, came to stress reason, that this man eventually had to come to the conclusion, however reluctantly, that really it's all within the mind. And that what really counts is not the external world so much as the landscape of the mind. Or to put it better, that what counts primarily is the landscape of the mind, the civil war that is waged in the landscape. But you can say that the war between the ego and the id is the war between the nice, rational Jewish intellectuals of Vienna and the mass movement of Goethe. It's transported to the mind, yeah? Between the ego and the id, that this Civil War, after all, he discovered from his studies in clinical urology, from his view, which he at first shared with no doubt with everybody, that the brain was physical, and that indeed the mind was expressed by physical and outward signs. But this he had to give up through his cases, through the case of Anna O in 1882, where, after all, hysteria was cured by a simple relating of childhood experiences, by the discovery of 1892 of free association instead of hypnosis, hypnosis which was still scientific at the time of a thought to be. And finally, in 1897, the very shattering discovery that what his patients told him was a lie. In other words, that what patients told him about their experience and dreams was not at all true. And therefore, the whole matter of psychoanalysis had to be analysis of myths and symbols, there is indeed a difference between true and apparent reality, and that was to have a very great effect. For it is through that discovery, of course, that Freud came to concentrate on dream interpretation, because he thought dreams were really the surfacing of the subconscious, and that in dream interpretation you really get the myths and symbols, the series of lies, the disguises, masking of the real Civil War that's going on in your brain, the real cutting the tie with the external. So in 1900, in his famous book, The Interpretation of Dreams, famous later, as I told you, he had to explain how certain elements of the dream are constructed out of latent material from the dreamer's childhood. And he thought, therefore, to discover the meaning of symbols in dreams and in the symptoms of dreams. He believed, therefore, that in dreams a kind of primitivism surfaces. The layers of civilization, the connection to the outside world, which lead to lies and disguises, are completely cut. Like on primitive people, like in folklore, in legends, in jokes, he thought, in all of that. And of course, these dreams are childhood experience. As he believed, parents appear as the king and queen, and little animals or vermin may represent unwanted children or pesky brothers and sisters. The number three represents the external male genitalia, which has, I remind you, three parts. So then all these interpretations, which like the dreams that you would read about in Dora, may seem to you very far-fetched, are all based on cases. In other words, Freud would say, I discovered them because analyzing the dream, like the dream of Dora, in this particular way, I was able to cure the patient. You will see that in Dora's hysteria, which is a hysteria of coughing and soreness of the throat that Dora cannot get rid of. When it comes to her dreams, you will see the analysis eventually leads down to the fact that though she dreams about the number three, it's the male genitalia, and then Dora dreams about other things, and eventually it comes out that really she is in love with her father, the famous Oedipus complex, and that her father has another woman, and that she once as a child saw oral sex. And once this is talked out by Dora, Dora is cured, and the irritation in the throat and so on vanishes. Now, this kind of explanation of symptoms, which you will read in this case of Dora, Freud would say, this is the proof. The proof is in the cure. It's a medical idea. The proof is, after all, in the cure itself. So we must, I think, be quite clear here that Freud attempted to apply to the pure scientific medical criteria. And that these medical criteria, he tried to keep as near to positivism as possible, as far away from any irrationalism as possible. What he really tried to do, and I'll come back to it at the end of the lecture, is he tried to make the irrational rational. Irrational, rational, and that we shall see is what I would say now. That fits in with, how shall I put it, a general response of intellectual Jews to the growing irrational nullity of the age. It is this idea of making the irrational rational that, for example, led to the founding of the discipline of art history after the First World War, which was again a Jewish sect at first. Because again here, there were people like Warburg in Hamburg, people whose names I will not bother you, Cassirer, the great philosopher, who tried to make the irrational rational, who were fascinated by myths and symbols, in order to give them irrational interpretation, and in order to integrate them into a rational system of values. That is the beginning of the entire myth interpretation in art history of Panofsky, of all the great art historians, in fact, that kind of interpretation. But it also becomes very strong in one branch of philosophy, the philosophy associated with Ernst Cassirer and others. But Freud is directly in this line. To respond to a more irrational, which in this case of course meant more anti-Semitic world, by trying to analyze the irrational, show its transparency. For Freud, in the last resort, the irrational has no value. You have to capture it rationally, and then the hysteria is over. Once Dora is told, yes, you told me a bunch of lies, but the idea of the bunch of lies, of these myths, these irrational myths of you, they have really a rational base. The rational base is the oral sex of your father with his mistress. Then it is integrated in an oral and concrete, in a concrete and rational framework. And similarly, if you analyze a Dürer painting and you say, yes, this myth means this and that, you integrate it into a rational and ordered worldview. Similarly, in this kind of philosophy. Now Freud himself tries to apply this, of course, to literature and art. And indeed, in a way, it comes down to the fact that for Freud, nobody means what he says. Nothing can be taken on face value, which is a very comforting thing in, you know, in irrationalism. I mean, if you want to put it really on an absurd level, you can say to any anti-Semite who calls you a dirty Jew, well, yes, I know why you witnessed your father's oral sex. And that puts it in a nice framework. So, which you can deal with. You can deal with it. Deal with it. He doesn't have to have it. So you can cure it. So, in other words, really what I'm saying is that Freud and eventually art history and eventually the new German philosophy are all attempted cures for irrationality, are all attempted cures for an ever more irrational world. And in Freud this is quite clear. No one means what he says, because culture comes through repression. Modern works of art have to be seen through, they have to be analyzed through. And so you can recapture for rationality. Just as dreaming is wish fantasy, as the basic thing of dream analysis is wish fantasy. And to analyze the wish fantasies in dreams, you get to the bottom of the real and concrete events which have led to this kind of hysteria, if you like, or maladjustment. So he writes about poets. Poets, why poets? Because we can never relinquish anything. We can only exchange it for something else. In other words, he thought of poetry really as a kind of exchange. We cannot relinquish tradition from the superego, as I told you last time. We cannot, in other words, relinquish totally rationality. The ego fights for that. So poetry is really a trying to find a way out that can be analyzed. Poetry is a wish fantasy, another wish fantasy of the id. If you like to put it technically, a wish fantasy of the id, which breaks through the ego and superego, just let us say, as your dreams are a wish fantasies and have to be adjusted in this way. Now, to be sure, Freud believes that there should not be too much repression. But on the whole, culture is only possible through sublimation. Freud assumes that, and what he assumes is that culture is rational. Culture has to be a rational construct. Culture is only possible through sublimation. Sublimation, the aim. Culture is, in fact, the result of adjustment. And he believed that the First World War was an expression of the aim. A result of the fact that there hadn't been enough psychoanalysis, if you like, enough strengthening of the ego and the superego. And he believed above all that if you want really to strengthen the ego and superego, where you have to have less suppression is in childhood sexuality. If everything is due to your childhood sexual experience, then it follows that a more liberal education, that is less repression of childhood sexuality, will prevent hysteria more than anything else. So what in fact Freud led for was not for a great less of suppression on adults, but rather less of suppression for childhood sexuality, which means, of course, sexuality of adolescents as well. Now, until 1918, Freud tended to combine the id with the pleasure principle. It's very typical that for Freud, pleasure was blind will. It's typical for the kind of bourgeois society that you study, for the Jenny triads, that blind will gives you the greatest pleasure. In other words, Freud assumed that real pleasure is the blind will. If you're blind will, it's a cope and you will have the greatest pleasure. And therefore, in a sense, the whole of Freud was to sublimate the pleasure principle. The sacrifice, he says, you must make for culture, for civilization, is the sacrifice of pleasure in the last resort. And sublimation means the sacrifice of pleasure. Strengthening the superego, the ego, and the ties with the external world, sublimates pleasure. This comes from Schopenhauer again, because in Schopenhauer, the blind will is in fact the expression of pleasure. The greatest pleasure, therefore, is that sort of thing. Society means repression of pleasure, because it means adjustment, which is necessary. Without this, there can be no social life and no culture. It's clear. But already by 1912, the pleasure principle tends to be a principle of violence. Already more and more, Freud fears the id, not because it is the pleasure principle, but because it is a principle of aggression, violence. Already in Totem and Taboo, which he wrote in 1912, he posits violence. The primitives kill their father. And just as in Moses and Monotheism, which he wrote later, he posits that men remember that once upon a time they had a primitive father and they killed him. In other words, the Oedipus complex becomes really something of violence. Where before the child had had this love attachment, this childish sexual love projected on the father, which of course is what Dora is all about, Dora has an Oedipus complex. That's why she minds her father having the sex with his mistress. Dora has the Oedipus complex, obviously. But the Oedipus complex now becomes, in a way, an aggressive complex. Which it isn't. The libido, the sexual energy you all have, the libido which has to be restrained, now flies into violence. No longer merely does it mean a repression which leads to tickling in the throat or whatever, but now it means actual violence, the killing of the father, the killing of the father, a growing idea of violence. This, the killing of the father, is obviously something that becomes important, for it means a new factor, if you like, of personal violence, which is now introduced into the mental landscape around 1910. As he said, restriction of the individual's aggressiveness is the first and perhaps the severest sacrifice. Though the severest sacrifice by 1912 is no longer the sacrifice of pleasure, but the sacrifice of aggression. And indeed, Freud comes to believe that aggression and pleasure are much the same. And that is again tied to history, and tied, if you like, to already the rumbles of wars, the Balkan wars, the growing destabilization of the situation in Vienna itself, the coming to power of this Lueger movement. All of that has undoubtedly a great deal to do with it. But once you have the violence, the transference becomes still more necessary, the repression. Now, by the way, Freud was totally wrong about primitive peoples. In 1927, the anthropologist Malinowski wrote a very famous book, Sex and Repression in Savage Society, in 1927. And Malinowski proved that far from killing the father, really in primitive society, the sexual relations were quite different. That indeed there was love for the father, domination by the father was accepted, and all of this. In other words, he was quite wrong about this. And this has, of course, been true of psychoanalysis all along, where psychoanalysis leaves case studies, leaves the medical realm, and tries to analyze history or literature. It tends to come be wrong and become absurd, because you can no longer have this kind of proof. If you see Hitler became the way he was, because if you'll excuse the expression, he lacked one of his testicles, which he did. Then, of course, you are being absurd. And it's very easy to prevent another Hitler, because you just see that those who rule over us have two testicles and not one. It should be very difficult. So what you have, therefore, is when psychoanalysis leaves it, it tends to become absurd. But it is the case study, and that is even true of Freud. He usually got it totally wrong when he went to things like this. Now, what it means in the end that social life, culture, is burdensome to the ego, but necessary. It is the product of control, victorious repression and sublimation. But Freud was still in a tentative state, and the general insecurity of all comes in a relation, in his personal and probably somewhat homosexual relation, to another doctor, Fleece, and his belief in Fleece's theory. Fleece was a doctor in Berlin whose theories were very famous at the time. He wrote a famous book of life and death in 1914, in which he put forward a rather typical theory of the time, a theory that you must not interfere with nature, that nature is important, a kind of Darwinism. Yes, you must never interfere with nature. And therefore, nature gives you signals. So, life and death has the following thesis. Life works according to the natural rhythms, which give the hour of birth and death. And therefore, the natural rhythm of children are linked to their mother's menstrual periods. the 28 days of the mother. And in the book which I have, you can figure out, if you know your mother's menstrual period, for the rest of your life. And you can figure out the best days you have operations and the worst days you have operations. And everything else, yes? The best days to marry, the worst days to marry, whether your girlfriend's menstrual period depends, to correspond with your mother's. If they don't, you're in for trouble. So, in other words, this was Fleece's famous book on life and death, and the interest. Well, I'm a victim, because all my youth I was sent to Dr. Fleece, who didn't believe in operation, so he burnt out my tonsils with a like a blowtorch. Once a week, I hated him. Once a week, this little man, I didn't know how famous he was as the friend of Freud, of course. I just went to him once a week in Berlin, and he put a blowtorch to my tonsils, because you must not operate, you must not interfere with nature. My father was a screwball who believed in similar theories. You mustn't interfere with nature, and therefore when it really came to take out my tonsils, it was a major operation. So anyway, so much for little Dr. Fleece and his theory. But the interesting thing is, not my tonsils. All our parents probably in those days, that silly theory of his nature. But the interesting thing is, that Freud believed in it in a while. And there you can see his insecurity. His relationship with Fleece was very close. And he believed in even such theories. There you see, the rationalism was sort of dislodged a little bit, yes? But there is a positivism to Fleece, of course. You can say, you must not interfere with nature. It's a positivist idea. It's a typical idea, of Haeckel, of matter, and of nature, and all of this, and sort of the same. But you can get that book out of the library, Fleece's of Life and Death, and try it out. I don't want to say it isn't true. I tried. I had one eye operation on the right day for Fleece and the other on the wrong day. Believe it or not, one was good and the other wasn't. You must never underestimate the irrational. Now the attraction is, of course, again a kind of scientific determinant. And the pull of reason of science against this awesome and discovery. Freud always had an ambivalent attitude towards the occult. He could never deal with it typically enough. And he had a hostile attitude to all of religion. Religion to him meant hysteria, the hysterical repetition of prayer. I mean, much of religion is getting to heaven by repetition. Much of it is a repetition. And for Freud, this kind of repetition made a kind of hysteria, a kind of clinging to things, a kind of broken relationship to the external world. And again, it is the archaic nature of symbols. And it is very true that Freud equates unbelief, atheism, with critical thinking. In this, he remains a positivist all along. That atheism is the same to him as critical thought. For example, and again you come to rather absurd interpretation. In 1923 he wrote, "What in the 17th century are evil spirits, to us are evil wishes, the derivatives of impulses which have been repressed. God and the devil are father substitutes." In other words, you can have an early post-complex on God, or Freud, okay? Father and the devil are in a way, father substitutes, but evil spirits are nothing else but repressed wishes, and you deal with them the same way you deal with dream analysis. So there you have it. But after 1918, Freud changed. Two reasons. Well, the war. Irrationality, external reason, but I would put to it the internal. Freud got cancer of the mouth, and for the next 20 years he had to live with an artificial mouth, which which is a terrible thing. I don't think they've improved it very much. And he was quite totally dependent on the services of his daughter, Anna. He got cancer of the mouth through smoking. Yes. So he got cancer of the mouth, and in a sense, two things in his life correspond. The end of the war, revolution, counter-revolution, the rise of mass movement, the strong rise of anti-Semitism, especially in Austria, where Hitler came from, the strong rise of anti-Semitism and irrationalism, and at the same time his cancer, his false mouth which he had to put in, and so on, with which he had to live. They all came together. And so you get now a profound pessimism. What is latent is now expressed more fully. The pleasure principle now becomes the death force. Destruction. Aggression now becomes, in a way, destruction. The id is not merely aggression. The id is now also a death force. It's gone quite far away from the pleasure principle of the early Freud. Quite far away to the death wish, if you like, it goes that way. What he calls the id, he says, is self-destructiveness. It's a death instinct. It is a death instinct. And the erotic instinct, the libido, is ever closer to the instinct of death. So you have it there, evermore. The necessity of repression is increasingly now the need for authority, the need to substitute the authority of the father, which is a bad authority, because it's based on sexual attraction, it's based on childhood libido, or let me put it better, this attachment to the father means that you have not grown out of childhood, that you've not been able to cut it, like Dora. You have not been able to grow out of childhood. But remember, for Freud, all children are sexually attracted to their parents. It's just a matter of shedding it eventually, or keeping it. If you keep it, it will result into hysteria and jealousy. If you shed it, you won't have these problems. Now we believe that you need another authority. That in order to shed your wrong attachment to your father and mother, your sexual wishes, your libido projected on your father and mother, you need a new authority. Before that, it was culture and civilization and liberalism, all that sort of thing. But after 1980, it becomes ever more authoritarian, and it becomes ever more a search for security. And that may have something to do with the war. Because in 1915, Freud wrote, "I have never been concerned with anything but security." That's of course wrong, because he was concerned with liberal society. But now he is ever more concerned with security. Self-sacrifice, that is sublimation, repression, is not an ethical thing. It is a social command. And this is, I think, of course, the best expressed in a book that he wrote after the First World War, The Civilization and Its Discontent, which is usually wrongly taken as Freud's permanent view. It is not, because in Civilization and Discontent, we have authority. We have all of this to the nth degree. We have other things. So let me read you something from there. What is necessary, he said, is that you repress and you sublimate. Why? Because the end result will be a state of law to which all have contributed by making some sacrifice of their own desire. Now that's fine. That was always his idea. The state for him was always a Rechtsstaat, a legal state, a liberal idea. But now it becomes much more. Because now he gives a definition of culture which is much more authoritarian. Now we have seen that order and cleanliness are essential cultural demands.
Now
that might come right out of Fox Point or Whitefish Bay. Order and cleanliness are the essential cultural demands, right?
Right?
If you learned at Nicolet High School or wherever you've been, no? You learned it badly. You've been there, it's hardly put in practice. So, what we have here isn't a definition of culture which is liberal, but liberalism now combined with order. Cleanliness was always there, but now it is order. Although the necessity of them for survival is not apparent, but it is nevertheless there. In other words, cleanliness and order are as necessary for survival. They are now necessary to help the ego and the superego defeat the id, defeat aggression and the death instinct. And the task of the psychoanalyst is now, in a way, to cooperate with a state that must be a state of cleanliness and order. Yes.
Isn't that directly contradictory to discipline in the army, which is what fights all the wars
right.
to begin with? The wars are fought by disciplined armies.
Yeah.
Doesn't he see the contradiction there?
No. I mean, Freud was never against armies. I don't know your question. Freud was never opposed to any army. He was never opposed to any war. He was not a pacifist in the First World War. He was an Austrian patriot. No. But it's discipline and order, see. Now, what you have therefore here is sublimation of instinct is an especially conspicuous feature of cultural evolution. It is that makes it possible for the higher mental operations, scientific, artistic, and ideological activities to play a part in civilized life. Now, I think all of these things are more or less self-explanatory. Man now, for Freud, longs for a return to authority, to the primitive father, but the proper father, the father state, not your own father. The father state rather than your own father. No wonder that he now comes to admire strong leaders. Freud, after 1918, in his despair, looks for strong leaders, democratic strong leaders like Clemenceau in France, and not so democratic strong leaders. He supported Dollfuss in Austria. And his opposition to socialism becomes much more pronounced. For socialism does away with private property, as he says in Civilization of its Discontent, and private property is one restraining element that helps the ego and superego through competition. Private property is a restraining element now, something he never really articulated before that. And so he fears all irrationalism, the irrationalism of the left, which was just as great as the irrationalism of the right from his point of view. But he never supported Austro-Marxism. He never supported Austrian socialism, which was one of the most feasible of all European socialists. He never did. He was typically of the Jewish middle class. I still remember when my sister first moved over to Social Democrat in 1929, and there was a big scene at home, and my mother said, you would get an illegitimate child sooner or later. And since then, I have associated socialism with illegitimate children. Otherwise, it's the toothbrush shared by everybody. This time it's legitimate. So, in case you think the Social Democrats were so mild in these Jewish liberal households, they were just as bad as the right, that's often forgotten, because we see things by hindsight. And Freud was very much a part of this. And so, obviously, he fought socialism and he fought the right, equally, in positivism and in liberalism, which I have made clear. To be sure, his tastes were similar. Freud's tastes were banal. They are not unlike the tastes of the tribes. In 1910, he lists the 10 best books. Among Freud's 10 best books, there isn't one book to read here. There are things like Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book, Zola, of course, positivism, naturalism. Zola is on the list. Macaulay, Mark Twain. No literature before, no Baedeker, no Gene. I know nothing of that nature. It was what I would call an extremely banal taste. And indeed, in 1914, Freud wrote quite revealingly, I have never been able to really grasp the artist rationally. And for Freud, as I told you at the beginning, anything you couldn't grasp rationally, he couldn't cope with. And he realized his own limitation. He couldn't really cope with it. Unlike Jung, who went to the other extreme, as you will see on Friday, and for whom the irrational was all important and the rational less and less important. It's just the opposite. No wonder, therefore, Freud could not grasp new mass movements. He followed Le Bon. He liked Le Bon. If you like, he followed him. He rewrites him. But in 1932, with the Nazis before the door, if you like, under Portas, he writes the following passage in 1932. Our mind is no peaceful, self-contained unity. It is rather to be compared to a modern state in which a mob, eager for enjoyment and destruction, has to be held down forcibly by a prudent superior class. That is so typical for the later Freud's all attitude. I'll read it to you again. Our mind is no peaceful, self-contained unity. It is rather to be compared to a modern state in which a mob, eager for enjoyment and destruction. You see, the it is the mob. The mob has to be held down forcibly by a prudent superior class. The prudent superior class is the liberal bourgeoisie, who is for moderation, for reason, for decency. It's a sentiment we could all agree with, or all sensible people would agree with. But the problem is, of course, the prudent superior class lost out, of course, in the end, and Freud had to flee Vienna. Now, with all of this, let me sum up Freud a little bit. He reaffirms, in the same way in 1932, where the it was, there shall the ego be. Freud, as we have treated him, is a case study in the dilemma of liberalism, tribal society, but a liberal positivism based on reason and science in the modern world, where the scientists themselves were only too glad to be irrational. But Freud was not. It was a dilemma of, you like, a civilized person, looking into the abyss of the irrational, having come to it through medicine, through science, through positivism, looking into that abyss in the human mind and in the modern state, in the Vienna of his time and in the modern state where the id seemed to have triumphed. And this abyss getting more threatening after 1918, so that the id is no longer the pleasure principle, it's the death wish, it's aggression. It's all of these as well. And there has to be external authority to help the poor analyst to make an ordered society, to make a culture a society. The failure of Freud is, of course, as important for us as his success. Because in the end, the id triumphs. In the end, what he thought was supposed to be a science of adjustment to an ordered liberal society, to make possible an ordered liberal society, was to become, if you like, a fashion, without any even political overtones, a conscious one, a fashion. Freud was not for adjustment at any price. There is a second contradiction, that the Freud who believed that culture was a matter of sublimation and repression, that that tried deeply for a greater total. That that tried did, in a way, abolish innocence. That that tried, in a way, brought to the surface, into the discourse, into the discussion, the idea of sexuality. And through that was a menace to middle class manners and morals. It didn't mean to be. But through bringing in the discussion of sexuality, through positing, in effect, the domination of everything by sexuality, because sexuality, remember, is the roots of your whole personality, charged with sexuality, through making sexuality dominant over everything, in a way, brought sexuality to the fore, and through bringing it to the fore, meant again, really, an attack, if you like, on middle class manners and morals. He called this book Civilization and Its Discontents, but his whole effort was to rid civilization of its discontents, yet in ridding civilization, in a way, he had a paradoxical result. He had the result of bringing to the fore irrationality, sexuality, as the root of personality. And he had in many ways the opposite results from the results he wanted to have. He brought it to the fore so that it became fashionable. And if you have seen any modern play, you know that all modern theater is talking out your sickness on the stage. In other words, I don't like to see modern plays, because Virgin High paid $10. If I could charge $100 as a psychoanalyst for most of the characters. So what you have in the modern theater is just that. It became fashionable to be sick. And delightful. And people are apparently willing to pay any kind of money to see that sickness on the stage. So, what you have is quite different than Freud wanted. Quite something different than Freud wanted. Sickness became fashionable in the end. But then, of course, he couldn't foresee. And as sickness became fashionable in modern art and literature, especially, I think, in the modern theater, as sickness became fashionable, irrationality became fashionable. Sexual promiscuity became fashionable, and repression, adjustment, all that is out, because you don't go to your shrink today to sublimate and repress. You go to your shrink today to fulfill your little self. Yeah? You have happy promiscuity. That's what you go to your shrink today. So it became perverted, as we must say, but that wasn't Freud. Original intention. Obviously, psychoanalysis was not supposed to liberate the irrational, it was to suppress it. Now, as a matter of fact, it can very well be argued, and very possibly be argued, that Carl Gustav Jung, when he broke with Freud, understood this century much better than Freud. I would argue that very strongly. And that somehow Carl Gustav Jung's psychoanalysis, with his idea of archetypes, became just as important, perhaps not more important, for it went into our daily life. How often have you said to a friend of yours, you are the archetypical this and that, yes, consumer, quite often. It became a part, because in a sense, Jung is, of course, the psychoanalyst of irrationality. And inasmuch as our age is, of course, a more irrational and rational age, we enjoy our sicknesses, it is more relevant, and we shall come to Jung on Friday. But please don't forget to go to the